Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Last week, we learned that on July the 1st, roughly 1,100 Hamilton non-unionized salaried employees were going to be getting a raise. It was their second raise of the year. The first was for cost of living, and it's complicated. Anyway, means that 1,100 non-unionized workers, and it follows a protocol that is supposed to balance them with other cities, workers in cities our size. It follows a plan, but we're going to get as much as 15% more this year. And while talking about that, got talking with a number of the councillors in this city, and, you know, the warning bells started to ring that we are heading towards a tax increase for Hamilton residents next year that some are saying is going to be enormous, relative to anything else we've had before, enormous. My next guest says, I really don't see us being under 10, as in 10%. That is, that's going to send some shivers down some people who already were stunned this year by 5.8%. Councillor John Paul Danko is a councillor of Ward 8 here in the city. Joins me now. Councillor, thank you for this.
Thanks for having me on.
You know that when you say things like 10%, that some people are going to freeze in their spot or just like crumple to the ground. That's an enormous amount of money that we're talking about that people are possibly facing down the road.
It is a huge amount, especially in today's economy when people are seeing just their household spending not go as far as it used to, whether you're talking about your grocery bill or your utilities or just the general cost of living. On top of that, if you're talking about a very significant property tax increase, that could mean hundreds of dollars a year for the average homeowner extra that, you know, they really don't have in their household budget. So it's not something that any of us want to see, but I think it's very important that going into this with our eyes wide open, that we're honest with taxpayers of what we're facing in the next budget cycle.
So, okay, I think people appreciate your awareness and other councillors' awareness that this is a big amount of money. I mean, some people have accused councillors of having no concept. I don't necessarily believe that's the case, certainly not with most. But if we know that this is a huge amount and we know it's going to really sting some people, why are we still heading towards this big an increase?
Well, some of it is in part due to provincial downloading. So we're looking at about a 2.8% to 3% increase that's strictly because of downloading from the province when it comes to development charges and provisions of Bill 23. On top of that, we still have ongoing inflation, which is a little bit lower this year. So that's good news. But city contracts and just in general, things cost more money for cities just as they do a regular household. Staffing, as you talked about off the top, is increasing as well. The amount that we're paying both our non-unionized staff and also our union contracts are due this year as well. And then we have some really serious budget pressures, such as housing and homelessness, that last year alone saw a 30% increase from the previous year. So right now on everybody's tax bill, they're paying about 7% that is only going towards housing and homelessness. And that is a pressure that is just continuing. So if you add all of those up, we're at about somewhere around 9% in 2024 budget year before we even talk about the core city services like roads and parks and recreation, garbage collection, and services like fire and police and paramedics. So, you know, it's just a combination of all those things going on right now that are, you know, as we're going into the next budget year, all come together to you know, really make us concerned about where we're heading in terms of taxation rate.
So that being the case, and I'm glad that you explained that, but that being the case, should councillors, yourself included, but all of them, all 16 of you around the table, should there be a real consideration about bringing forward any more projects or any more plans? Because I haven't yet seen anything different. I haven't seen any move towards saying we can't do anything else right now because we've got all these things looming. It seems almost to be business as usual.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think council is aware of that. And we are making some progress on that. So council just passed our term of council priorities. And one of those priorities was to specifically to reduce the residential tax burden. And through that, coming up with a new budget process that combines the capital and rate budgets and operating into a way that's easier for residents to understand and easier for counselors to understand where there might be strategic opportunities and savings versus, you know, looking at things kind of a one-off. So that is moving forward. In the discussions, the mayor talked about the role of a gatekeeper to make sure that we stay on our strategic term of council priorities. And that is us as a council collectively, but also the mayor through her expanded powers that she has in the strong mayor system. And we hope also our constituents, which are certainly going to keep us, you know, on track when it comes to budgeting.
But there are still some things that were talked about a lot in the campaign that haven't come up yet. And I still expect that we're going to hear about them. We haven't heard yet about the area rating being gone, which would affect certain people and drive up their rates. We haven't heard yet anyone really seriously try and talk about the free transit, which we heard a number of councillors say they wanted to do. Is it not, should I not expect that some of those things that people ran on are going to get brought up, or do you believe that those things now have been shelved for the time being?
I think those are still, you know, part of the discussions, but I think when we're talking about, and what I saw, you know, this past budget session was everybody putting together kind of their wish list of what they wanted to get out there, get done, and get into the budget as soon and as quickly as possible without any real long-term strategic planning on a number of the items. And that was really concerning for me. So I think moving forward, if we're strategic about the plans that we're putting forward, whether that is, you know, transit subsidies, or if it's our climate change adaptation and mitigation, bike lanes, you know, kind of those things that are a little bit more sensitive politically, that we are putting those forward with a true long-term strategic plan that we're investing, and this is the goal that we want to achieve at the end of the day. So it's not just, you know, putting a motion forward and then getting millions of dollars approved on the back of an envelope.
But am I not correct, though, that, for example, you mentioned bike lanes, and that's a great one to mention. Am I not correct that it's already been brought forward, that the bike lane project that was going to take 25 or 30 years has been already compressed to 3? That's the kind of thing you would think that if we went back to the original plan would cost us a lot less right now.
I think it depends. So if we're talking about a brand new purpose-built multi-use pass, you know, incorporating that into existing roadways, that can be quite expensive. If we're talking about making bike lanes a priority when it comes to maintenance work that we're already doing, then they can be incorporated very effectively. So again, I think, you know, as long as we're strategic about the plans that we're bringing forward to make the city the kind of place where we want to raise our kids and age successfully, it's being deliberate about how we're investing that taxpayers' dollars.
Last thing, we got to run. Should there be significant discussions or serious discussions about cutting stuff? That it's just time that, you know, we have all these things we have to add. We have to now make some hard decisions, and we just have to cut some things and live with it.
I think that's a discussion that council does have every year. And inevitably, you know, does it mean going to biweekly garbage collection or things like not clearing our snow as frequently or not fixing our roads as frequently? Those are difficult discussions to have, but I think it is something that we do consider every budget cycle. But those are obviously difficult discussions to have with residents because inevitably it means cutting a service or something that does affect the residents in the services that we deliver.
John Paul Danko, Ward 8 Councillor, always appreciate you coming on and talking about this. Thank you.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Really interesting column in the Globe and Mail on the weekend or late last week. I'm not exactly sure which day it was, but that doesn't really matter. The point was this: we are heading towards, not immediately, we've got a little while left, but you know, we always follow this stuff. We're heading towards a federal election at some point. And right now, Pierre Poilievre has a lead. The Conservatives have a lead. Who knows if that'll hold up? But if it does, the column raised the question, what if, based on the lead that he has in the polls, what if Pierre Poilievre won but didn't win a majority? And the Liberals and the NDP decided they're going to continue to work together, which would then give them combined more seats than the Conservatives. And Justin Trudeau or whoever was the Liberal leader, or frankly, if it could, I guess, be the NDP leader potentially. But what if they then declared We together have more seats, therefore we are forming government. It would be legal, but what kind of issue, if any, would this create within our system? Kate Harrison is vice chair of Summit Strategy. She joins us now. Kate, how are you today?
I'm not too bad, Scott. How are you?
I am well, thank you. This is a fascinating one because it's completely within the rules. It's completely legal within our parliamentary system. Mm. I just can't imagine how this would play in on both sides if those two parties were to do that.
Yeah, and we don't have to look too far back into recent political history to see how even the prospect of that type of a coalition government was received by Canadians and how they ended up voting as a result of that prospect. So it was, you know, just in 2008 where the Conservatives drummed up the possibility of a Liberal and NDP coalition at that time. And it was resoundingly rejected by Canadians. You're right, the system we have does allow for it. This was also tried in the 1920s and something any astute political historians listening would refer to as the King Bing Affair, or at least anybody who graduated grade 10 history. So it has been tried, but what has been the result of those attempts in the past, or even just the rumors that this might happen, is that Canadians have said, no, that's not what we want, and that they voted kind of accordingly. So it is a possibility. The thing that's different about this time, Scott, and the reason why I think there's a little bit more legitimacy to this particular claim or you know, the prospect of this is because of the supply and confidence agreement that currently exists with the Liberals and the NDP. Effectively, if it holds for the duration, they will have governed for a majority mandate under this confidence agreement. They could go to the Governor General and say, listen, we've just shown you that we are able to make Parliament functional. The Conservatives, despite having the most seats, don't have a majority, and so we think that we can continue to govern. So that's what's different about this compared to the recent past. But I think a lot of Canadians, if the Liberals and NDP seat count goes down and the Conservative seat count goes up, will be scratching their heads wondering why they have a coalition government when it's clear that's not what they wanted.
That said, so, I mean, we're talking about how and we'll get to more about how the Conservatives and their voters might react to this, which I think would not be good. But on the other hand, if you've got more people who are voting for the NDP and Liberals combined, that probably means that more people would say, yeah, I didn't want the Conservatives in, so this is a really good idea.
It's possible, but then, you know, the question back to that would be, okay, well, then why has Justin Trudeau kind of declined democratic reform as he promised to do when he first came to power in 2015? So, We have the first past the post system that we have. There's pros and cons to it. Can have a very long debate about that vice kind of other systems like proportional representation. But I think there's something to be said, Scott, about kind of putting the choice directly to Canadians about the kind of parliament that they want to see. And so, you know, even though the system allows for kind of a coalition in practice, unless it's really clear to voters that that's what they are getting, you can understand that there'd be quite a bit of hesitancy there to accept that. So unless there's a broader conversation around changing up how we form our government, which, again, Justin Trudeau opened the door to that conversation in 2015, and then he himself closed it to a lot of displeasure from the NDP and even some of his Liberal colleagues. But he chose to do that because it politically, for him, was the more convenient route. The PR system, I think, would have posed some problems to the Liberals that they didn't necessarily anticipate when making that promise. And so now they have the best of both worlds. They can continue to govern as though they have a majority with the support of the NDP, and they don't have to go through the hard work of actual electoral reform.
Again, I want to stress that this would be entirely legal, nothing illegal about it. It would be entirely within the rules. I do wonder, though, if doing something like that, you know, while it may be very tempting because you could hold on to power, and I'm sure the Liberals and NDP feel right now like they are making the country work really well. They're doing a terrific job, so we should keep going, and people would be happy with that. What are the chances that if this were to happen, though, that you end up with, a constitutional crisis in that you end up with a bunch of people in the West then who this would be the last straw, and you would end up with a party in the West that probably would have some legs that would say we're going to separate because we clearly at this point now have no say in anything. We even won the election and we didn't win the election. It's rigged against us. I worry that we end up with a country that then starts to get into real separatists.
Yeah, if you think national unity is a problem now, I suspect it would be an even bigger problem then. And yes, for sure, a huge issue in the West. But I would also say potentially an issue in Quebec. The Bloc Québécois has the potential, I think, to have a bit of a resurgence in the next election, particularly if they kind of continue aligning with a lot of the same policies that the CAQ at the provincial level has. So if there's a scenario where, you know, a lot, the majority of seats in Quebec are not even held by the Liberals, and there's an attempt to form power there, you might have both the West and Quebec extremely upset and irate over this, which is why I come back to kind of the numbers and the seat count. If you have a scenario where the Liberals and the NDP have both lost seats, and current public opinion kind of suggests that would be the case, or the NDP might hold, but they've had a diminishing return with Jagmeet Singh as leader each election that they've faced. I think you would have a really tough case to make to Canadians that yes, these are the folks that we want to return to see govern. The Conservatives should not really overplay their hand on it. Although I think when we get to an election, especially if they're doing well, you're going to see a lot of the talk about the importance of the majority, like you did under Harper, but you know, I do think that you want to be careful about it because, to your point, it is a completely legal thing to do, though perhaps not the right thing to do, at least in the eyes of Canadians who haven't actually been asked to vote on the matter directly.
I guess the question really becomes, and, you know, we could ask this the other way around, too. This is not just a Liberal or NDP thing. This is for anybody in politics, is how tantalizing is power? Are you willing potentially, and we don't know if this would happen, but are you willing potentially to really stir up a hornet's nest to hold on to power? Or do you look at it and go, we'll regroup for the next election and try and win again?
Well, and I think part of the answer to that lies in how long Justin Trudeau is actually prime minister, right? I could see an attempt at that. When we had this issue in 2008, we weren't talking about a leader of the Liberals who had governed for years and years and years. The Liberal government did, but not the Liberal leader at that time. So Trudeau, by that point, will be potentially 9-10 years into governing this country. There's a good possibility that maybe he would just be tired. And in my view, he's kind of already used the snap election bullet in the chamber, so to speak, in the most recent one, calling an election over nothing in 2021. It resulted in the exact same outcome that we have.
Oh, did we just lose Kate?
Election,
there we are.
Bullet. So I'm not sure that, you know.
We're going to have to let Kate go. We're having all kinds of suddenly technical problems. We love having Kate on. We'll have Kate on again. Kate Harrison from Summit Strategies. But it is a really interesting scenario to contemplate, because right now, if you look at the poll numbers, this is exactly the picture that is painting of what we could be facing. It's exactly the picture we could be looking at. And the question would then become, would the Liberals and NDP, and maybe Green as well, I don't know, they probably don't need to bring them in, would they consider doing this? And what would it mean? And how would it be received? In some parts of the country, in Ontario, it would probably be fine. In BC, it might be okay. In Atlantic Canada, it would probably be okay. But would this create such divisions in the rest of the country that it's not even worth? I don't know. It's a fascinating one. It's a fascinating topic. I'm glad it was brought up. Really interesting one to consider.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I feel like we should have some oom-pa-pa music playing here, or maybe some yodeling from the Alps. I'm not really sure, because Don Robertson, mercifully not wearing lederhosen, is back from Germany after a European vacation, laden with schnitzel and various beers, I'm guessing.
I was given some advice. Day and a half in Germany. where Suze was on business, and then we went to Switzerland for 5 days. Got some advice from a hockey buddy that played over there. He said, eat and drink whatever they tell you that you should. So I'm pretty good at both.
Yeah.
So lots of schnitzel. Tried the beer, and I'm not a draft beer guy, but I tried the beer. It was wonderful, mm-hmm. and everything over there is great. And I did discover that we really don't have any old buildings in Canada to speak of. They got stuff that's theirs isn't decades old, it's centuries old, and it's very cool. One observation I take, though, is they have an inordinate amount of bike lanes.
Yes.
I mean, there's bike lanes all over the place. The only difference between the bike lanes that I saw in Switzerland and the bike lanes I see locally is there were actually people riding bicycles in the bike lanes, and it was busy. It wasn't just the odd random guy. I mean, they're like little highways. So, I mean, I guess it's a good idea if you can get people to on some bicycles to use them, but they seem to all ride their bicycles in great big long lines out where I live in the sticks, but they could go in their lanes downtown.
Yeah, no, it's... Well, it's a I don't want to get into the whole bike lane debate here, but it's a little trickier when you're riding from Flamborough to come downtown than it is to be riding just through a European city, which tend to be a lot more compressed.
Well, I've been downtown Hamilton, and Dundas has lots of bike lanes, and you know.
Yeah, but how many people are riding in the morning to go to work are riding from Flamborough to downtown Hamilton on bike lanes? That's my point.
Absolutely none.
Whereas in European yeah. cities, many people can leave their apartment or their house, and they're not far. They're maybe 10 minutes away, and so it's an easy bike ride. It's a different geographic thing. But
so you're supporting bike lanes?
I'm supporting
in bike Europe.
Oh yeah,
in Switzerland.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm all for bike lanes in Europe. You know what? And we can talk about you know what we should be doing with them here, but. You know, I'll tell you my one beef with bike lanes in Hamilton, this is not the topic for today. We can do this another day.
Sports.
My one beef with bike lanes in Hamilton is that in the wintertime, I will often see sidewalks with a foot of snow, roads covered in slush and snow, and bike lanes scraped down to the concrete. When there's not one person with four healthy brain cells who's going to be out riding their bike when it's a blizzard outside, but they've got them, you know, it's like they've heated the road underneath. It's like a heated driveway, and no one's riding in them. Do the sidewalk first. The bike lane, you know, in the middle of a snowstorm or right after, the bike lane should be about the last thing you clear in order of priority, but that's, you know, again, that's a discussion for another day.
Well, I guess they pay more... gasoline tax, so that it's a priority.
The bikers, like our cyclists, yeah.
Like the province give us a lot of money from the gas tax for roads and construction, maintenance, and everything else. And used to be our licensing fees. That's all gone away now. But there's no, I mean, put some licenses on bikes and have them pay for some of the cost of the conversion. I better quit getting in deeper. Mm.
But Germany was, you would go back, Germany, Switzerland, you would do it again?
Absolutely.
Did you learn to yodel?
I could yodel before I went, just not well, so yeah. I didn't.
And only after drinking, a lot.
No, it was one. Suze set the whole thing up, and, you know, we were sitting a month before we left, and she said, what do you think about going here, what do you think about going there? And I go, I've never been there, it's all new to me, so I'm sure whatever you pick is wonderful, and she picked the hotels. We went to a place called Zermatt. In Switzerland, and you can't get there by automobile. You have to take a train. And it's kind of cool, and it's old streets, and it's lots of stores, lots of expensive stores, and...
No, Switzerland's not an inexpensive place.
No, it's not. And the Matador Mountain, there must have been a million people taking pictures of it.
Matterhorn. Yeah.
And then I got... I should have paid more attention because I'm not a hike guy. I don't even like going up on my shop roof, which is one floor, the ladder. We went up, I think it was 7,800 feet in a gondola to the top of a mountain that apparently on a clear day you can see five countries. I didn't go within 20 feet of the edge of the restaurant I was in. I mean, that was an error in judgment. She did a wonderful job taking care of all the plans.
I have traveled much of the world. I've spent a summer in the middle of the jungle in Papua New Guinea, and been to Korea, and been to the Middle East, and been to Africa. And Europe, which is where everybody goes first, is the one place I've never done. It is high on the list of things to do one of these days. But
do it.
I will live vicariously for now through you. And speaking of Europe, there have been an inordinate number of photos, getting to sports stuff, there's been an inordinate number of photos online this week of athletes from other sports wearing their London Wimbledon finest attending Wimbledon this year. A bunch of PGA Tour guys and a bunch of hockey players and a bunch of other people who are spending their summer making a pilgrimage to Wimbledon to watch. I don't know. There's no special reason that I know. There's no specific thing this year. They've just all gone to Wimbledon. And I was wondering about this. Like, Wimbledon is on the list for me, but is there one place that you have always thought, either one venue or one event? It could be an event as opposed to a venue. Is there one place or one thing in sports that you would put at the top of your list as, man, I've got to get there before I die?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Super Bowls are kind of cool, but it'd be too busy for me now. I mean, in my 20s, it probably would have been a lot of fun, but not now. I don't think there is. I mean, Wimbledon is a destination. I think maybe at this point, watching, this would be cool, Canadian Open, which won't happen, but a U.S. Open or something at Pebble Beach.
Yeah.
The thing I've learned about golf tournaments, though, I mean, Pebble Beach is kind of cool. My life is down to very poor golf on a regular basis. It's hard to watch it. I mean, I watched a little bit of the U.S. Women's Open, and a lot of the greens and everything else, and you've been to Augusta on more than one occasion. It's hard to get a prime spot, and there's no real nice walking paths to get there. I'd break my ankles because I got bad ones, but that would be a challenge.
There are seats at Amen Corner. There are bleachers where you can sit there for the day and watch the guys coming in and teeing off and then teeing off again. That one for sure. I'll tell you another place that, like, one of my places I would love, there's a bunch of, and I'm not even a U.S. college football super fan, but there's a bunch of stadiums for the experience that I'd like to go just for the, I'd love to go to a game at Clemson for the introduction, mostly for the beginning. I'd love to go to a game at Michigan University. I've never been to a football game at Michigan University in the big house. You've been to a hockey game there, I know, an outdoor game.
I've been to a football game
there. Have you?
I've been to one NCAA football game in my life, and that was the place. And everybody's saying it's 100,000, 103,000 seats. And you're walking up to it, and it looked like old Ivor Wynne Stadium until you walk in. And there's a big bowl. I mean, it was unbelievable how many people were there. The other thing that I found particularly unbelievable is I said, I'll go get beer. The guy sitting with me says, yeah, that's a great idea. I go up, and I said, where's the beer outlet? They said, we don't sell beer at these games. What happened? The kids there were hammered.
Yeah. Well, they were a little pre-drinking before they showed up. Yeah. I'll tell you what else. If you have not been, anyone who has not been, it's about an 8-hour drive. Got to do it. Before you're done, you got to go to a game at Wrigley Field, a summertime game at Wrigley Field, sitting out in the bleachers. The greatest place to go to a game, period. I know Rogers Center has its charms. It ain't Wrigley Field.
Susan and I are going there next Thursday night.
Are you really?
Yeah. We're leaving Wednesday.
Are you really?
Yeah. We're leaving Wednesday. We're going to drive because we did the math on the timing. Pardon me. We're going with some friends, Gordon Barb, and we're going to drive down. And we're driving down Wednesday morning, and Thursday night we're going to go to Wrigley Field. Last year we went to Fenway Park to watch the Jays. But I might look like Rumpelstiltskin the next time the Jays play at Wrigley Field. And guys like you have told me the historic significance of it.
Got to go. The two things, we're going to bore people to death here, but there's two entrances into Wrigley Field. There's a different entrance for the bleachers. So you come in off a different spot to go to the bleacher area, or you come in through the regular part. But if you go through the regular part, like as if you were sitting in the behind home plate or first or third baseline, the cool thing is you walk up these cement ramps that you realize were the exact same ramps that people walked up back in 19-whatever, the day Babe Ruth called his shot. Or, like, the history of the place
is that
just
where he
amazing.
Called his shot?
In Wrigley Field. Yep. Yeah, and now they've got a beautiful statue of Fergie Jenkins outside and of Harry Carey outside, and you go to Wrigleyville, there's all the pubs around it, and it's an amazing. Wrigley Field is amazing. It's amazing. And the other place that there's a lot of other places people would choose to go. Because other places that I would really, really love to get to is I would love to go to the Kentucky Derby one time at Churchill Downs.
Yeah.
I'm not even a horse racing guy. Like, I can't.
I go there.
I don't know that I've ever watched a horse race live. I mean, I've never been to the track. But I would absolutely go to the Kentucky Derby.
Sometimes claimed as the most exciting 2 minutes in sports.
Yeah. Stewie writes in and goes, you got to go to a football game at Notre Dame. I would agree with that, Stewie.
Yeah.
That would be on my list to do for sure. Also, I would love to go to St. Andrews, although it always to watch the Open. Although I must say that I'm a warm weather guy. I'm a bit of a wuss. And St. Andrews always looks unpleasant, like howling wind and really chilly and not. It's almost like, okay, I wouldn't mind just walking across the course and seeing I was here and then watching it on TV where it's warm.
Well, but TV is the place to watch golf. I mean, there's no...
Almost every sport.
Question. Yeah. Yeah, there's not many that... baseball's not bad, but it's... they got the big screen. So we were down there, and I don't go to a lot of these venues, but... We went down a week ago, I guess, to Rogers Center to see the renovations.
Yeah.
And that's all geared to young people. I mean, that's what they're doing, I guess. They're not worried about an old fart like me. But, you know, there's some nice party areas. But, boy, the amount of money they spent, I'd want more money. I'd want a bigger bang for my buck than what they got. I mean, you can see that they raised the bullpens up so you can, you know...
Yeah, but you know what, Don? I was talking to someone about this the other day, and they said, like, you can get that. I think it's a $20 admission. And I know you're saying they wanted more bang for their buck for the renovations, but
yep.
Now they've got this I think it's a $20 admission. You don't get a seat, but you can go hang out in the outfield. And I'm thinking anyone who's hanging out there is probably buying 5 or 6 beers during the course of a game that go, what, for $15 a beer? You're making more money off the people standing out there than
let them
buy
in
a ticket.
You can let them in free.
You could, and you'd still make more money than if you sold them a ticket somewhere. The other place that I would say, honestly, and you're going to think I'm nuts for saying this, that you have to go to before you're done is the Lomedy Park, which is in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. It's the home of the Little League World Series.
I've been there.
It is during the tournament?
The day it ended and had dinner in the restaurant that overlooks the field.
You would think, oh, that's goofy. It's 12-year-olds playing baseball. You can't believe the setup and how good it looks and the professionalism of it and everything. It's an amazing, and it costs nothing to get in. Parking is free.
Yeah.
It's
very cool.
It's very cool.
It's very cool.
Makes me wish that my son's team had won one more game a few years ago and got down there. They would have been destroyed.
That's when they hosted in Ancaster.
Yeah, and they missed it by one game. And he said this, I've said to him a couple of times, we went down a couple of years afterwards and then a little while later, and we're sitting there and I said, you ever think about what would have happened if you guys had won that last game to get there? He goes, all the time. They would have been completely obliterated. They would have run into Japan or something and the game might still be going on because they couldn't have got out of the first inning.
Well, they have mercy rules, don't they?
Yeah, but you got to get to 4 innings. You got to get to 4 innings. You could be down 4,000 to nothing at this point. We could be importing arms of kids who weren't even born yet to be down there to try and finish the inning. But it would have been a lot of fun to go.
It was very cool.
It would have been a lot. Anyway, let me
like
know.
A big theater.
Stewie says Notre Dame. Let me know. 905-645-3221. Send us a text. What's the place? We started this by talking about Wimbledon. What's the place that you would absolutely want to go to? Maybe you've been, maybe you haven't been and you want to go, but what's the place that you have to see if you're a sports fan before you're done?
You know, it's kind of funny. You talk about Wimbledon, right?
Yeah.
We talked, and I mentioned I'd gone to Fenway, and now we're going to Wrigley. And you start thinking, first of all, there's no old hockey rinks to go to.
Not anymore.
Like, they're all cookie.
Well, Madison Square Garden would be the closest, but it's been redone.
Yeah, the rink's on the third floor,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's, Yeah, it's been redone, but it's not historic. The outside of the building may look like that, but I can't think there like the stadiums other than baseball stadiums.
Football and baseball. Lambeau Field would be.
Yeah, Lambeau Field. Yep. Tiger Stadium's gone.
Yeah, no. Most everything is gone now. I mean, even Yankee Stadium is no longer Yankee Stadium.
No, still call it that, but it's not Yankee Stadium.
It's not the house that Ruth built. It's the house that Jeter built, really.
Yeah.
But it's no. There aren't many. That's the thing. There's not. I have no interest. We went to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway one time. My son had a baseball tournament in Indianapolis, and we went and. You can pay and you do a lap, not fast. We were in a van that goes about 4 miles an hour. But you get to do a lap of the track and they talk about certain things and everything else. I have no interest in going to a race there, but it was cool to go and to
see it.
To see it.
Yeah. Well, it's like St. Andrews. It'd be a lot easier just to walk around a few holes you wanted to see.
Yeah. Just then, to say I was there. And
I was going
to
say, you ever notice, like, you're right, the winds are howling and the rain's going sideways. And they're in
horrendous most of the time.
You need a stepladder to get in some of the pot bunkers. Nobody ever complains about the weather.
Nope.
Like, you know, the flagpole's bent almost down sideways.
So Mackenzie Hughes goes to the Open and goes, you know what, I love this tournament, but the weather here sucks. He'd be drummed out, him or anyone else. He'd be run out of England or Scotland or wherever. You'd be run out of the British Isles before you could finish your state.
Son, sentence. You won't have to worry about that again because you won't be back.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. But no, let us know. Let us know what would be the place that you would absolutely want to go or have been that everyone else really should, because this is there's a lot of the places. There's a lot of places that. That would be on the list. Bring Don Robertson in here. Now, Don, while you were away, Don, by the way, I didn't introduce Don at the beginning because I was talking so much about him being in Germany. He's the guy from Calm Choice Realty, and he runs the Dundas Real McCoys, and he's here every Monday except when he's gallivanting around Europe in his very, very swanky red sneakers that he's wearing today. I mean, these are special German walking shoes.
I was at the gym before I got here for my annual visit. I just had to tone everything up for the summer.
I hope at the gym they don't give you when you do your annual visit at the gym, I hope there's nothing like the annual visit at the doctor.
Felt like it today.
So while you were away, NHL teams had their development camps where a bunch of their draft picks and people that they're giving tryouts to and everything else, they get to skate and practice and everything else. Well, one of the Leafs' better prospects, Finnish guy, is in a scrimmage coming across center ice with his head down, and a kid who is trying to make the team who doesn't have a contract absolutely destroyed him. Caught him with his head down and knocked him out cold. Just blew him up. And this created all kinds of debate online and everywhere else, with people saying either, hey, that's how you show that you really want a job. You play hard all the time. Or, are you a moron? That's one of their top prospects. You don't kill the guy. That's not how you get attention from a team. If you're a general manager, which you are, you're a coach, and you're having a practice early in the season, you haven't even picked your team yet, and so one of your better players is not goofing around, but is not taking it all that seriously, apparently, and comes across with his head down, and another guy flattens him. Are you impressed with the guy who flattened him, or are you saying, what in the world are you doing?
I'm a little bit impressed with the guy that flattened him because he's trying to prove a point that he wants to play on a team. I'd be more impressed with one of our more physical guys went over and kicked the crap out of him for doing it. So that would be a successful event. And if the guy that hit him did well, then I go, Bernie, we better take another look at this guy. Like, he's not scared to hit. He's not scared to stick up for himself and so on. But, yeah, but there's a big difference in the scenario you gave me of one of our premier players, and Mark Juris is popular. So in Mark Juris's day, if somebody dropped him at center ice, I'd have a little chat with the kid. But
that's senior hockey compared to young guys who are trying to make million-dollar contracts.
But he may not have known who he was hitting. And this kid,
I'm sure he didn't.
In all probability, probably knew he was a prospect, but says, if I'm going to make this team or I got a shot at making the Marlies or getting a contract, a Leaf contract, a two-way contract with the Marlies in the East Coast, I better go out and hit some people, because that's what I do. All I do is hit people and play hard. And if you let up on that kid, maybe the coach is sitting there or the GM sitting there going, well, that's not what he does.
Yeah, why is he here?
Hit people. That's right.
I would bet money, which I don't do, but I would bet money that he didn't realize who the guy is. This is not Wayne Gretzky or someone who's got a familiar face that you're knowing. This is the guys here might know some of these guys from junior hockey that they've played with.
Yep.
But by and large, most of these people are going to be mysteries to them. They don't know who, and especially at full speed.
He didn't run Nylander over.
No, and at full speed, you're not going, oh, that's, you know. And again, maybe if it's Connor Bedard, who's the first overall, maybe because you've seen his face enough that he's familiar. This guy, you would have no idea. I looked at him, how in the world is anyone complaining about this kid doing this? I honestly thought it was fantastic, especially in a team that is always being accused of not having any toughness. You want to get noticed.
Well, I hear Toronto have a new GM since we've been together.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about having a bit more snot in his team, I think was his quote.
Yeah, so we've gone from wanting truculence and whatever the other word was that Brian Burke wanted to now just snot. We just want snot. I mean, look, in allergy season, I can provide a lot of that. Maybe that makes me maybe I can have a contract.
A candidate?
Yeah, a candidate. I can make a team. If all you're looking for is nasal drip, I'm your guy.
I think the GM was actually talking about looking for exactly what happened, right? If that kid's going, this is going to be a lot of fun throw there. This guy wants snot, I'll show it to him. So he hit that kid so hard that probably produced all he needed for about a week. But if that's the only way you're going to make the team, that's what you have to do. And the GM wants it. The Toronto Maple Leafs have been too hard to play or too easy to play against for a number of years. And I've said it and you've heard it anytime you ask. So full marks to the kid.
Yeah, I just don't get now. Okay, let me ask you though, if it was different, let's say it wasn't at development camp. Let's say this was at Maple Leafs training camp. And the guy that you're a young guy who's trying to make the team, a big defenseman who's trying to show his toughness, or a big winger. And let's say it wasn't no-name prospect that this guy's never seen before. Let's say you obliterate Mitch Marner and knock his jaw into the third row. Is the answer different?
So remember what I said would happen at a real McCoy practice? Somebody come over and tune him up? There'd be a couple guys lined up to tune him up. So you better expect that. And that's a bit...
But even then, would you be okay with the guy doing it as long as he's willing to stand his ground, or do you just not do it when it's a star?
You don't do it to your stars. You maybe if you want to take a run at Wayne Simmonds or something like that to prove yourself that you're not scared. But you start running over superstars and trying to hurt them, you're going to get a ticket to... I don't know where.
Well, you'll be playing where those shoes walked that you're wearing.
Yeah,
you'll
be back
playing
in
Switzerland or Europe or somewhere. But no, it's an interesting one because it created such an interesting discussion about what's the appropriate thing and what's the unwritten rules. And I don't know that there is one. I don't know there is one because I bet you I can more than bet you. I'm sure there are guys playing professional hockey right now, either in the NHL or some other level, but getting paid who weren't going to get paid. And that's how they made their mark. That's how they got noticed the first time, by just blasting somebody. Yep. And someone said, oh, at least I noticed the guy. He stood out.
Yep. Well, if that's like I said, if that's what you do, if you're there because you're a physical player, you better play physical. If you're a physical guy and what you're famous for is your hard work, you're responsible in your own end, you play a good 200-foot game, and you run people over, don't go to camp and start toe-dragging. Run somebody over.
Is this uniquely a hockey thing? So let's go say
I would say football.
Well, okay, but let's say it's Ticats training camp and you're a guy who's trying to make your mark. Do you wipe out guys because you're there to be physical? If you're a new guy and you're renowned, you've been drafted because you're such a hard-hitting middle linebacker, but you're not sure you're going to have a spot. Do you flatten guys in training camp because that's what you're there for, or do you line the guy up and pull up at the last second and then wink to the coach and go, I could have killed him?
I think Ben Zambiezi ran guys over.
I'm sure he did.
At camp or wherever, just to make the team and make a living.
Yeah. No, I don't doubt. I mean, I can't imagine. Well, baseball doesn't practice the same way these guys do. You don't have pitchers generally, except in training. Well, I guess in training, in spring training, they'll throw live batting practice, but you never see a pitcher go up and in on someone.
Well, they're not brushing guys off.
No, that's plate. What I mean. You're not doing that. So baseball doesn't really have that. Basketball, I mean, you could in basketball, you could have a hard foul in with a guy going to the net. You rarely hear about it.
But again, if that's what you do, I'll bet Dennis Rodman was mean at camp.
Yeah, I'm sure he...
Elbows up.
Yeah, it's such an interesting one that I will see if this guy... we'll know soon enough. We'll know soon enough if this lands this guy another look or if he ends up in, somewhere where they don't even have phones.
If he wasn't there for the second skate, you know what happened.
No, he was back. He was back, but it was near the end of camp. And so, as I say, we'll see where he ends up this year, if he ends up anywhere at all. You know, if he's on the Leafs Siberian farm team, you'll understand what they thought of it.
They could probably play in Dundas.
There you go. Frank writes in and goes, "Did you know you have to get tickets? You have to get on a lottery list for Wimbledon." I did know that. And you also for the Masters, you have to get on a lottery list. You can't just go online and buy them. And if anyone wins them, they know who they are. And each one, if you won and then sold them, you'd be banned for life from ever applying again. They are serious about that.
I'm sure they have season tickets and box tickets. They sold.
Oh no, they do. Well, they have people who are members and others who can get in. You said Ben was just talking beforehand. Ben was saying about somebody, Dimitrisson called in. Where did he want to go see?
He wants to see before they switch over to electric, the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
The 24 Hours of Le Mans.
And the
all
other
right.
one is to go and see the Isle of Man time trial.
The Isle of Man, okay,
incredible.
I don't know. Don't know much about that one. I will say that, Don, the one sport that I would never bother with going to see live would be, two of them. It's either the Paris to Dakar race or the Tour de France, because you set up all day to get a spot and then just, vroom, oh, they're by. Okay, go home.
Let's go home. That's it. That was a great 6 hours.
Yeah, that to me doesn't seem like it's a great use of time. I'll watch the Tour de France on TV if I'm going to watch it. Having a bunch of bikes race by me and not even be able to see them.
I've seen highlights on TV. That's not a whole lot more exciting than watching them go zoom by. Until they wipe out. Those things are always fun.
Any sport. Yes. Any sport, it doesn't matter what. Any sport, the wipeouts are always exciting. You're a hockey guy. You're a guy who's made moves and trades and everything. There's a really interesting debate right now because the Maple Leafs have William Nylander, who's not signed. They have other guys too, but wants a lot of money. And there's a lot of people saying, you know what they really need is a big, sturdy, rugged defense. You should trade William Nylander for a big, tough defenseman. And then the other side says you never, ever trade that kind of skill because that's really hard to find. Never trade skill for ruggedness because you can find rugged guys a whole lot easier and they don't always pan out. Would you ever trade a really high-skilled guy for a really tough stay-at-home defenseman?
If I could trade William Nylander for Chris Pronger,
I knew you were going to say that name. That name popped in my head. I knew that was coming.
I would do it in a heartbeat. So
but guy's not there. I mean, yeah, I would.
Ask me if I would.
No, and that guy, I mean, if you're talking about a Hall of Famer, sure. I'm talking about your, valid point. All right, if Chris Pronger was there or if Al MacInnis or if a Hall of Fame guy was there. But I'm talking about just a good, solid, stay at home, look after your own end, clear the front of the net defenseman. Not flashy, not going to the Hall of Fame, but kind of what you need. Would you do that?
Well, here's how I'm going to frame the answer, because I've been away and had lots of time to think about silly things, in case you ask me some. Who did the Vegas Golden Knights have on their team that is like Willie Nylander?
A bunch. Well, a few. Eichel.
Eichel's a big man. He plays hard. Eichel has a great 200-foot game.
All right.
And he hits.
He does, and there's not a lot of, you're right, there's not a lot of hitting in Nylander's game.
Well, there's none. And so my point...
Sometimes he's run into someone accidentally.
His own guy. So when you look at it, and you look back at recent Stanley Cups, and you say, how many of those guys are there on the team, if any, that play the role that Nylander does? Nylander is very, very exciting, and he has skill coming out as yin-yang. Like, he can do things with that puck that few people on the planet can do. But in the Stanley Cup playoffs, which is where it all happens and when it really matters, and Treliving will strive for that because he knows it's the playoffs in Toronto that are important. It's not getting there. It's seeing what you can do when you arrive at the dance, and you need every single guy you can get that can do that because, first of all, in the Stanley Cup playoffs, if you think you had half an inch to work with in the playoffs, you have less,
mm-hmm.
or in the regular season, you have less in the playoffs. So he's going to get the odd point here and there. But I'll tell you, if you had Mark Stone or I'd trade Eichel for him in a heartbeat. And here's the challenge when you ask the question, and I had to go back to Pronger. There are very few defensemen like that in the National Hockey League, and there isn't a general manager around that's going to get rid of one for a skilled, talented forward unless he's got four other stud defensemen, and that trade doesn't exist.
Right, and so, yeah, I mean, if you could trade Nylander today for, say, Victor Hedman on Tampa.
Yep.
Sure, I would do that.
Yep.
But as you say, there's probably five of those guys in the league.
32 teams, five guys.
Maybe 10, but I don't even know if there's 10.
And probably five A's and probably five A minuses. So,
and they're not,
every team doesn't have one.
No, and everybody wants one.
Yeah.
Everybody wants one. And so, yeah, I would always be worried if I was the GM that you trade a guy and he turns around and then puts up 120 points the next year, and you look like a buffoon.
So Willie Nylander would be far more effective on the Toronto Maple Leafs if he was the only one that played that way.
Hmm.
So if you had Matthew Tkachuk there, and you had Mark Stone there, and you had some of the really high-end, physical, all-round forwards there, and you had somebody that was just played the game a little softer, that'd be one thing. But you have Nylander or Marner. Marner's, like people say, Marner's not big enough. I saw Doug Gilmour 2 weeks ago. He's as big as Doug Gilmour. They call Doug Gilmour killer. Like, you can play that way if you've got the jam to do it. But the Leafs have got too many guys of their core four that don't hit. I'd like to see the stats on how many hits were thrown by the core four last year during the regular season and the league average. So they have an inordinate amount of them. That's why somebody has to be dispensable, I think.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.